Hi everybody, welcome to another episode of the 21st century thing.
21 CB thing. Oh.
21, okay.
That's good enough.
Okay. We'll start again. Welcome to another episode of the 21 CB thing.
Well done.
Great. I'm Singharava and I'm here with my friends Tara Palita and Dharma Sara.
Hello, hello.
Hey.
Hi.
And we're following the same procedure as last time. Mm-hmm. And I think, so every one of us has brought some quote, yes, poem, teaching, whatever. Mm. And I think I really enjoy just the kind of mixture of bringing things and not knowing what comes out of the conversation. Yeah. So I think it's a really funny thing, or it's a really fun thing, yeah. And I thought maybe Tara Palita, you want to start with yours, because I think in the last weeks you were always the last one. So start this time.
I will start.
So what did you bring this week?
Well, my usual go-to book, which is Pieces of Fire from Sangharakshita, lots of his little aphorisms and quotes. Mm. And, to be honest, I opened it just now. But I found a quote that Padmavajra was talking about in his series of talks recently, talking about Sangharakshita himself. But anyway, I'll just read it because I just found it really interesting. Okay. Hardly anybody is willing to give. Everybody wants to get. We search for someone without quote-unquote needs so that we can obtain from him everything for nothing, as it were. Is this perhaps the reason why Gurdjieff insisted that everything must be paid for? Perhaps it is immoral to give something for nothing. One is encouraging greed and selfishness. At the time of tantric initiation, one has to make a cash payment to the guru. How much one is prepared to give shows how much or how little one values the initiation. So I just thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think you need to read it again.
Yeah, read it again okay. Slowly so that we can take it in.
Hardly anybody is willing to give. Everybody wants to get. We search for someone without quote-unquote needs, so that we can obtain from him everything for nothing, as it were. Is this perhaps the reason why Gurdjieff insisted that everything must be paid for? Perhaps it is immoral to give something for nothing. One is encouraging greed and selfishness. At the time of tantric initiation, one has to make a cash payment to the guru. How much one is prepared to give shows how much or how little one values the initiation. So that I thought it was really interesting because he I think Bhante said that around, I'm not sure exactly who it was, what initiation it was. Was it Dujon Rinpoche? Mm. Or anyway, there was the whole thing of traditionally giving something for your initiation.
Yeah.
I think back in the day it was gold, wasn't it? Sacks of gold dust and
gold dust. Yeah,
yeah.
You have to give anything.
So I just thought there's multiple reasons why I found that really interesting when Padmavajra was talking about it in his talk. I guess also in connection on a personal level, you know, with one's own teacher, like you look at somebody, and you this whole thing of wanting somebody to have no needs at all, so you don't have to give anything. They don't need anything from you emotionally. They don't need any support. They don't need any. And sometimes I think many people probably have viewed Bhante in that way, Sangharakshita in that way, and have viewed other people. And so that was one thing. And also I just found it interesting, the whole, like, especially when I used to live in West London, and when it came to the Dana Bowl, I was just stunned because there were so many rich people there. And the change that you'd hear dropping into the Dana Bowl, like a £2, you know, a 50 pence. These people drive cars that are worth more than most people make in their whole life. Mm. And I said to my friend Jananad at the time, what's going on? You know, there's loads of millionaires around here. And he said, well, you just follow the money trail. It just shows you what you value.
Mm.
And I thought, whoa. So it's not a cut and black and white thing, but I just thought it was really interesting because it goes against, it's kind of, I think we've got, bit, I don't know about paranoid, but the whole kind of guru thing, like, if you have to pay for something and you have to use cash, then it's not the real thing, and everything should be done without money. And I see the point of, you know, you give things open-handedly, but there's a reciprocity as well, isn't it, where it starts to bite, especially when it comes to your money. It's like what you actually value and also taking into consideration the needs of other people that you consider to be your teachers, even like this whole thing about they looking for somebody that doesn't need anything from you. Anyway, so I thought it was an interesting place to start.
No, I think it's a really it's a big conundrum, like how to how to work with that, I guess, because of course there is a wish also to give open-handedly or like to share the Dharma for free, and I guess that's also the Bodhisattva ideal, to just not charge and to be make it available. So, but at the same time, I mean, I can definitely see that it's a question of how much do people value what's just being shared for free.
I think it's quite interesting that the whole thing about, because in a way I get the sense it's not, he's not being charged, is it? So I think the open-handed giving, you just do that anyway, but then it's down to the recipient, what they feel to give. I think that's the difference, isn't it? Like a class here, whether you can even call it a class, but a class here, just to say that, it's like there's no fixed rate for it. It's not like, oh, going to a yoga class where you pay, I don't know, 15 euros or something. And it's an open-ended thing. You know, if you have no money, there's no money. But if you've got money, then how much are you going to put in? It's kind of, it's a bit of a, it's a quite, it can be quite an uncomfortable situation where you just think, well, I've done it loads. I think, well, how much? I just was perfectly happy to blow, I don't know, I won't divulge my spending habits on clothes, but I was perfectly happy to spend a vast amount of money on a pair of jeans. And now this person's given a really good class and I'm like, oh God, do I just put in like 10 euros? Is this, really? It's a question mark, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it comes down to our relationship with money in a way. I think it's, you know, when we say we, there's always a bit of a tension, isn't it? When we ask then for money for donations after our classes, because we, well, we want to look like, oh, we're just doing this for free, but at the same time, we do need money as well. Yeah. And I thought it was interesting because I was, what you just said, because when I remember correctly, apparently Bhante described those initiations as, well, they weren't, you know, you weren't expected to give a certain amount the donation, for the initiation. Yeah. So he gave you an initiation.
Yeah.
Well, and you gave, well, a lot, but how much was kind of up to you. And even poor people would just give a little bit.
Yeah.
Now I was actually listening to a talk by Bhante recently about offerings, the symbolism of offerings from that series, Creative Symbols of Tantric Buddhism, and, and well, you get that all the time. So the you know, even in the oldest scriptures, the Buddha gives a teaching, and then the people will just bring something, will host him. Usually, it's the other way around. Even they give something first, and then he will give a teaching. Maybe that's something to bear in mind, really. I'm just having a bit of an aha moment here on how to approach donations here as well, to kind of say, well, this is the kind of culture we want to. I mean, we always say that, we want to establish a culture of generosity, of giving. We give freely, you give freely. But there's some, I mean, there's a story behind that. There's a whole tradition behind that of, well, if you, you ask someone for advice, or you ask someone for, well, a teaching, or, you know, to show you something, well, you bring something. You try to host them, you know, even though they're coming here to our home, but you're trying to show your appreciation, or
it's probably not very embedded in our culture, that kind of thing. And I guess in Asian cultures or even Eastern European cultures, this kind of hospitality or whatever is much more widely spread or apparent in people's culture. But I also thought about a teaching that I have been reflecting on. And so it's a mind training teaching, and it also gives different things, different areas to practice. And I think one of the nine areas is to, if you want to create merit, then the first thing is that you need to give service and material support to your teachers. So this is one of nine things that will lead to compassion and wisdom in a way. And I also thought, oh, that's interesting to have that as one of nine things you need to practice, giving service and material support to your teachers, because I guess we've probably not have that but so much in our awareness that, that in a way, I mean, we need to be, we need to look after our teachers.
Yeah. I mean, on paper, it looks a bit dogmatic, doesn't it? You think, And we're so cynical as well. You know, yeah. You read this stuff. Even when you were saying it, I was like, oh, yeah. You know, it's just like the part of me is like, oh, yeah, give support to your teacher. And it's so negative. It's unbelievable. I don't know why we've got so cynical. It's terrible. But just when in practice, like I remember, not to blow my own trumpet, I'm hardly like an exemplary when it comes to this sort of thing. But, you know, like my friend Jananda in London, I used to buy him shoes and buy him things. And just like, because he didn't have much money, I just felt really good. I didn't feel like, oh, I'm like supporting his whole life, but it just felt like a really nice thing to be able to do, to just just support people. And I think once you step in, it's like, well, it's what they call generosity, the basic Buddhist sort of virtue.
I mean, it's the beginning of the path. I mean,
you have nothing, right?
I mean, we always talk about the threefold path, you know, which is kind of condensation of the eightfold path, which is ethics, meditation, wisdom. But then people say, well, for there's actually a fourth step before that, which is dana, which is generosity, which is giving. So for the so-called, you know, householders and laymen, it was dana, well, it was generosity, ethics, and meditation.
What do we think about that, though, really? Because we'll say that quite a lot in classes and to each other. But what does that, because that's quite a thing, isn't it? That whole spirit of generosity. And I think once you start practicing Buddhism, you do end up naturally, it just makes sense. It's like it is a very, you know, Bhante's whole thing about a nucleus of a new society, you know, you're starting something new, having a culture that is really based on generosity. It's quite a radical shift in a way. And when you take it, it sweetens the atmosphere, doesn't it? Anyway.
Yeah, and I guess if it really comes out of natural generosity, I mean, it's such something also that is really freeing in a way if you can let go and give and be part of something. But I guess it really needs a spirit. It needs to come not out of like kind of looking at things from a perspective of what's in here for me, in terms of usefulness or whatever. So it really needs to go beyond that kind of material exchange.
But it's interesting because it does kind of relate to a value, isn't it? You know, that's a whole system of, commerce works in a way, isn't it? You've got, you value something highly. Maybe there's not much of it in existence. So you're willing to pay a vast amount of money for it. And that thing you will prize above everything else because it's like, there's a real energy behind it. You've spent so much of your time and energy working for it. You know, you put in hours and hours and hours of your life. And now you have this thing and you really pay attention to it, don't you? I remember my dad was with his uncle, who is a Japanologist, like Dharmasara. And he went to some lecture in, I think, UCLA in Los Angeles, where he lived. And this guy was talking about these, not pottery, but, you know...
Ceramics,
yeah. And apparently there's a case of one guy who'd, I think in medieval Japan, who traded more or less everything he had for this pot, this kind of vase or something that was just so beautiful to him. He just traded everything. He'd given away his house. It was super fine, rare. And I just thought it was a really interesting story because obviously that it held so much weight in his mind. And it was such a, it obviously had some sort of so much significance for this person. They were willing to trade almost everything for this object. And you see, you can imagine your mind is gathered around that object then. So I'd imagine with the whole initiation thing, you know, like Marpa and whatever, you know, bringing sacks of gold to the teacher for an initiation. When they've given it to you, in those days at least, it's like, wow, you'd really value what you've been given because you know that it's got a power to it and it will change your whole life. Yeah. Here's all my money because I know now I'm getting the whole world in a way. It's like you'd sort of...
But I guess it's also about really seeing the Dharma and the value of the Dharma as... this kind of precious object in a sense. And I guess if we really can see the value of the Dharma for our lives and the life-changing effect, then I guess if we could really see that, we would be willing to give everything we have for that kind of, to be able to be into contact with that teaching. And I guess I think the more we kind of it trickles into ourselves, yeah. the more we can be.
We do that, don't
yeah.
we?
Yeah.
We do that. I mean, I don't think we necessarily talk about it in these terms of paying for, obviously for paying for initiations, but we do it in terms of commitment, don't we? This whole thing of like, people's deepening commitment. And it's like your life starts to change. Do you end up giving everything in a way? Anyway, in terms of your time and what you're doing with yourself, it might not be a lump cash payment, but there's some sense of like you've sort of, and not in a, yeah, like you said, not in a slavish way, you know, like, oh, I'm going to give everything and be a martyr. And
no, yeah, it's
understanding it properly, yeah. isn't it, for it to make sense. Yeah,
yeah, it does need the spirit. What, you know, you talked about Singarava, about it, that we need a spirit. And I was just reflecting, yeah, you almost need to forget that you're supposed to give in order to be able to give.
Right.
Because sometimes it can get a bit of a rule, like, oh, well, you know, yeah, like, yeah. you know, I get up to meditate and then we're also supposed to give each other presents or yeah. something. You know, we need to be generous. We need to give money. So it can get a bit dry and disciplinary as well. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think, well, I mean, isn't there's this aphorism, isn't there, from Padmavatra? I only heard it from Padmavatra. He's, I don't know, maybe it's Bhante, or I can't remember, which is this thing of that which you love, you adorn. So so you know, when you, so there needs to be love first then in order to give. Yeah. And I noticed that. I mean, I'm terrible with birthday presents and I always forget birthdays of people. But when I absolutely love someone, then I just, naturally, I just give things. Yeah. You know, like you said, with Jinananda, you just bought him presents because you wanted him to be well and you wanted him to...
Yeah.
So it's more for... Yeah. You almost forget that it's even a practice to give. Exactly. That's the spirit, isn't it? The kind of...
Yeah.
At the center, there needs to be love and appreciation and friendship in order to...
Yeah,
and I guess also, I mean, what this reminds me is that, of course, in the mandala of the five Buddhas... generosity, or the mudra, the gesture of the open hand, is connected with Ratnasambhava, who of course is also connected with creativity, inspiration, the arts, all that. And I guess that, and of course the jewel, the Chintamani, which is the symbol for the source of boundless inner inspiration. And I guess if that giving comes out of that richness, the wealth of inner inspiration, then it doesn't really feel like something that
I think that's it, because I think what it's not talking about is a kind of narrow moral, even religious box ticking. It's not talking about, oh, well, that was a really good class, so then I'm gonna put in this what I do all the time and like I'll tick and then go off and have a cappuccino. It's not like that, is it? It's not like a formulaic thing, is it? Mm-hmm. Where you just kind of give. I mean, it's good to have standing orders, so it's like, you know, regular, but that's on a practical level. But I think the spirit of it, like, it's not just like a moral exercise in a narrow sense, is it? Where, oh, I've done my duty for the day, I give this much and that's enough. It's not like,
no,
you know, ticking the religious box of being a good Buddhist, is it? It's like, oh, well done, you know. Yeah, it's more out of inspiration, is it? There's a whole upsurge of well, inspiration, and sometimes it manifests in material items where you just think, oh, I really want to, like you say, adorn this person. I love this person or this place. Let's put in.
And you want others to benefit as well from what you've benefited, just like when you're, I mean, when I've been in touch with a teacher who's really inspiring, I think it's this like, wow, that's great. I mean, others should have the same opportunity in a way.
Yeah, it's not something
you can legislate. It's not just for myself.
Yeah, you can't legislate for this either, can you? You can't. In a way, you can only, this only works, I guess, if people are doing it themselves and you step into a culture of it. It's like, you can't ask people. It's not part of your kind of duty, is it? Maybe it is, anyway.
I mean, that's why we invite so many people here, like Maitreya Bandhu. You know, you brought Parami here because you benefited from her. So it's like, we want to share. Share the people, share the wisdom, share the
inspiration,
the good things.
I actually have something that probably would fit quite
good,
well.
Good.
Shall I go on?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe. Mine doesn't fit yet, so.
Okay, maybe it will fit afterwards. Then we'll make it a good sequence. So I want to bring in some verses from the Bodhicharyavatara, which is a very famous Buddhist text. For those of you who don't know, it's written by Shantideva, who lived in the 8th century in India. And he wrote that training manual for future bodhisattvas, for people who want to become bodhisattvas. And so it begins with some lines, verses of worship, and these verses are also reflected in our puja and our devotional rituals. And so there's some of those verses that I really, really like, and I will read them. Three verses I brought today. So, you who are accustomed to traveling abroad among the trading towns of the realms of rebirth, grasp tightly this gem that is the awakening mind. It is precious, essayed by those of immeasurable expertise, the unique caravan leaders of the world. Like the plantain stem, all other good things assuredly shed their fruit and then wither, whereas the awakening mind is a tree that constantly fruits. It does not wither, but continues to produce. In its protection, as in the protection of a hero, one immediately escapes great dangers even after committing extremely cruel acts of evil. So why do ignorant beings not seek refuge in it?
Again?
Okay. We could go through it verse by verse. Maybe that's easier. So, you who are accustomed to traveling abroad among the trading towns of the realms of rebirth, grasp tightly this gem that is the awakening mind. It is precious, essayed by those of immeasurable expertise, the unique caravan leaders of the world.
That's great, isn't it? It's funny. It's one of those ones that Padma Vajra is very keen. You know, very keen on the whole trading towns of existence.
It's a great symbolism, it's fantastic. Isn't it?
Yeah, the whole thing of like, well, you're not home. You know, you think you're from Berlin or think you're from Spain, and it's like, oh yeah, you know where you're from, and there's this whole sense of transitoriness to our existence
traveling abroad. Towns. You're just a traveler and these merchant. And I think the trading town is, I mean, it's a really good symbol for samsara in a way, because it is the place bargaining, and it is the place of the eight worldly winds, like. Gain and loss, fame.
I mean,
and
he probably had in mind also the, you know, you had these Buddhist kingdoms. I think at the time when he lived among the Silk Route, so obviously that was at the back of his mind as well. I mean, the Silk Route was probably alive for hundreds and hundreds of years, right?
I think even before.
I mean, he's eighth century. Must have still been.
The Buddhism to China arrived there in the second century via Silk Road, so that must have been long before.
But still, I think even there were earlier, these, you know, like Khotan and other. They were by the time, you know, there were these huge kingdoms along the Silk Road, which are now like deserts, completely deserted.
That is, I mean, as Buddhism. A byproduct, that is for me a slightly. I read. Okay, we're back, but just a slight tangent, this whole thing about the Silk Route I found really interesting because I read a book on the Silk Route, and it is fascinating, isn't it? Like, you've got these places that were real centers of learning and culture, like in, forget where they are right now, but they're like real learning, and you just think, wow, this is amazing. And then you look at where they are now, I don't mean to be horrible, like I've got, anyway, but like Kyrgyzstan and all these other stans that we now, it's completely different. They're not vast centers of art and culture. And I thought, wow, I hope it's not the same with us over here. You know, we're doing so well, and then you fast forward 1,000 years and.
But I think that's what's going to happen, unfortunately. I mean, look at Nalanda, where Shantideva lived, which was, I think, one of the biggest Buddhist universities at that time. And there's nothing left, even left any Buddhism, almost any Buddhism in India anymore. So,
But it's a good image, isn't it? The trading, the kind of transitoriness. Because I think, in a way, that there is a certain feeling of lightness, like, oh, it's a relief. Because we get so stuck, like we're trying to make this work, you know, but actually we're just, the whole, it's a cliche, isn't it? But we're travelers and you can't take anything with you, as they say.
That's just nice because I immediately had that image of like a caravan, and then within one sentence, he just makes it cosmic, you know, he makes it, you know, the, what was it, the trading towns of...
He says that the trading towns of realms of rebirth, so the different, of course, it's not only in this space and this time.
You always go from one next rebirth to the other.
So he says, grasp tightly this gem that is the awakening mind. It is precious. So, and that's what reminded me of what we just talked about before, the Dharma, like realizing the preciousness of the awakening mind of
The will to enlightenment.
The will to enlightenment.
The wish to gain enlightenment.
So this is what's really precious. This is what's really valuable. This is the only thing that can lead us from this life and out of this life. So it's essayed by those of immeasurable expertise, the unique caravan leaders of the world, which are, of course, the Buddhas and the wise, the sages who have tested and really kind of understood the preciousness before us and who can then kind of lead us out of our
So I guess the image is then that you get a caravan that travels from one city to the other, but then because it's said the caravan leaders are the Buddhas, so that means the image is obviously that the normal caravan is a bit lost, maybe, you know, they might just always go from one town to the next, from rebirth to rebirth, and then you have good caravan leaders who lead them out of that cycle or something. I'm just trying to get the metaphor.
The metaphor, but I think that's what he suggests, that of course there are leaders actually who can lead us out of out of the trading towns in a way.
I don't know if it was in that poem that you read a few weeks ago, but I think that Sangharakshita wrote about leaving the leaving the shore, and there's like people buying and selling. That's it. Padmavajra is talking about there's a lotus in the lake. Anyway, this person, the whole poem is about leaving the shore, isn't it? And this whole business of people buying and selling and the noise of it all. And when you're in that trading town with the noise, and you forget that it's not actually everything. You don't have to put your whole life into the trading town. It's like there's a whole other something. It's a really great poem. I'll try and dig it up. The noise and the hustle and the bustle and the chaos and the smelly fish and the broken wheels and you just off.
Yeah, so there are sages out there, like the fourth side. And I mean, there's somebody out there who can lead to a different realm. So I'll read the next verse and then we can look at that as well. So like the plantain stem, all other good things assuredly shed their fruit and then wither. Whereas the awakening mind is a tree that constantly fruits. It does not wither, but continues to produce.
Well, that's really interesting, because in a way, like, I think that speaks, where it is a poetic description of practicing quote unquote properly somehow, isn't it? You know, because you do get a sense that, well, at least I do, that there's all sorts of endeavors that I'm engaged in and they have a kind of life and they die and you think, oh, what happened there? There's a whole cycle. But the strange thing is, it is kind of exhilarating, isn't it? When you find your way into the Dharma, you fall out again and you find your way in and over years and you're in again, you're out again. But when you're in, you do get a sense of like, oh, this thing, this actually just fruits continually. And the reason it's not fruiting is because I probably need to sort something out psychologically or in terms of my living conditions or whatever. But when you're in, that's why it's so... I imagine that's why we're all doing this thing, right? Because it's like you just get this sense of a continual fruiting. That's what it feels like. It's like richness and a growth. And you're like, wow, unending.
I mean, that's what Bhante, the Buddha, I think, describes as well. You know, the two different ways of existence, isn't it? So one is more, you know,
reactive
and cyclical. So it's like one thing gives rise to the other, but you know, there's a constant waxing and waning, you're coming and going, whereas, you know, once you've, which is basically, you know, rebirth and all that and karma, you know, that all works on that level. But then there's another way, you know, when you really start to practice the you know, what we call the spiral path, then everything just flowers and fruits into the next step, you know. So, for
tangible.
Example, just like, you know, like faith, yeah. flowers into joy, flowers into rapture, flowers, but you don't lose the steps of the first stage, you know, you never lose that. They never go away or change. Yeah. They just become bigger and thus kind of fruit, and then all fruits into enlightenment, hopefully.
Yeah, but I also resonated with that because I was thinking back and looking back at my life, and I think being a quite passionate person, I think I can always see like these kind of things that I was passionate for at some stage of my life, like really being passionate for theater or for singing, for the orchestra and whatever, whatever, some kind of film star or different things. But I can really see like how they all were not sustainable in a way, like all these passions just burnt and then they kind of at one point
you get like a wave, don't you?
You get like a wave of excitement, but then you have nothing that's really kind of continuous. So looking back, I can really see myself like all these kind of different discontinued passions. And there's no real kind of continuity or threat. And so I think with the Dharma and practicing and really wishing to kind of transform, evolve, learn, I can really see this is different because it really, there's no end in sight. And I can also really see the kind of continuity.
Didn't you also go to like different churches and African churches?
Went to an African church when I was 13. So it was quite... interesting.
Where they were speaking in tongues and
everything.
You always had that urge to find something, but then you couldn't quite.
But it's being passionate about these kind of things, but then you can see, okay, it's not sustainable. But with the Dharma and with really wanting to I guess I really needed this context.
It's a really interesting point, though, isn't it? Because I think for some people, you know, if you haven't been fortunate enough to come across Buddhism, for example, I mean, it sounds horribly religious, sorry, but if you haven't been fortunate enough, in my opinion, to come across Buddhism in a way that actually really speaks to you and grabs you, yeah, like really speaks to you, then you are in a position where you could, and I know people like that, where you're going to have to turn your passion into something more, where, you know, I know people like musicians, for example, where that's what it is. And you're going to have to find your way. And it's the same with great artists, I imagine. It's like you or a scientist, or any aspect of life, isn't it? Or whatever aspect. If that's what it is, then you will, it becomes a discipline at that point, doesn't it? Where you have to kind of find what you're looking for within it. You have to find it. It can't just be a kind of, it's not just a kind of a passing phase in a way. It's your journey.
Yeah. You over-identify with it then as well, I guess. Like,
I know what you mean. It's not quite what I mean. I just mean like, you know, so you're going to have to, you have to find your way. Hmm. You will have to find your way within that framework, won't you?
Within that mode of expression.
You will have to find your way of looking for truth, meaning, absorption, all those things, won't you? Anyway,
Yeah, I mean, I can see that with my life as well. I mean, I also had many different passions and interests, you know, from playing in the orchestra or, you know, science and all these things. But if it doesn't, you need to find a framework that actually encompasses the whole of your of your being. Because I was always greatly interested in these things, and I could have probably gone quite far within, you know, I don't know, with music, you know, playing the bassoon in the orchestra or whatever. But I was always too aware of the existential emptiness I felt inside that I kind of needed to find something that was more, and I couldn't find that, you know, I couldn't find the kind of friendship, the kind of meaningful process or path in those areas for myself. I know others can, like I've just always seen that in, you know, my orchestra friends or something. I've always seen them being really, their life was music, so they saw everything out of that, you know, from that lens, from that viewpoint. But I just somehow couldn't. I needed to completely different framework that's much bigger than myself.
It's to do. Yeah. It is a bit to do. It is to do with passions in a mature or immature sense. Because I think I've had loads of passions in my life, but they've been even though I wasn't a child, they've been sort of infantile to a certain extent, where I'd get really excited and then, but it wasn't me. I couldn't push through. It wasn't quite. I couldn't quite explore. And so me personally, I was kind of left with a blank in a way. Although it wasn't a blank, because I had found something that seemed to be open ended, and I think it is. But anyway, I really like the thing you're reading, just because I think experientially, that's just what it tastes like when you're in it. But I mean, also, you know, the whole thing about the Dharma, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to try and actually be practicing at a level that's satisfactory, where you do feel like you're kind of all in. It's really difficult, you know. But I just more and more acutely, for some reason, these recent weeks, I just feel like I'm trying, but I just get a glimpse of how little of me is actually in it. I'm kind of in it, and then I'm not. I'm still called Tara Pilot. I'm still doing classes, but I'm a sort of not quite in. I'm not in the tree that's continually fruiting. I'm kind of talking about it and help. Maybe other people are in the tree. That's great. But and then I just thought, oh no, that's what it is. It's not like I'm gonna this in out thing where you're kind of on retreat and then you're bouncing around the place. It's like, no, I thought you've got to get inside it, and it's really difficult. It's like such a subtle kind of spirity, ghostly thing. It's like you know, you just stepped into it and you're like, oh, I'm here again. I've got to stay. And normally what happens to me is I'm in there and then I get so excited without knowing I'm excited that I bounce out and I'm gone for 2 weeks. And I'm like, oh God. And I'm back in and then I'm out. And I thought, oh, that's the thing. When you're in, you've got to know you're in and try and just, it's like, oh, this is it. This is the place.
I think that's the thing that's so difficult to
grasp tightly, this gem. Yes. I mean, this is what it is.
Grasp tightly the
quicksilver elixir.
Exactly,
but it's so difficult to understand, I think, because otherwise, well, if we're getting in contact with Buddhism, obviously what we do is we start meditating, probably. But it's so easy, I think, to understand Buddhism as a sort of technique or as a sort of mechanism. Like, well, okay, I'm a bit stressed, I do a bit of mindfulness, or I feel a bit angry, I do a bit of metta bhavana. But then to, you know, these practices can sound very sort of techniquey, but actually to make them relevant to something that actually goes way beyond you, like way, I don't know, just sort of to make them...
It's not techniquey, is it?
No, it's not at all. It's like, it's... And then, you know, I mean, we talk about these things like, oh, mythic context, and you need to find a mythic context for your life, da-da-da. And, you know, you get all these... we talk about all these things, but then how do you actually do that? It's actually... We're so ridden in our minds by techniques, and we just want to know how A leads to B. And I think this is where Buddhism gets misunderstood, because we do talk about...
methods
and conditioned existence, so it just sounds perfectly logical, but it isn't. It completely isn't, because what we're dealing with is the whole, not just the mental, but also the emotional, the subconscious, even the mythic elements of ourselves. So we kind of need to. So it always feels like we're trying to kind of mold something which is in the dark, and try to push it in a direction where we actually don't see. Like, it's always like, when I meditate, I always feel like I'm working in a fog or something, but you're just trying to move, and you're trying to move this huge ship that you actually can't see in a water that you can't see either, and then try to steer it somehow, and then but as you go, you will realize, and on looking back, that I did make that kind of makes sense now. Things are kind of coming to place now. I can.
Yeah, we're not those clear,
continuity, people. And you can see continuity in some moments.
I mean, you do get the sense sometimes with Buddhists that, well, that it's kind of like, oh, they know what they're doing.
Yeah,
they're clear. And sometimes I think Buddhists are clear. They know what they're doing. A lot of times it's the murky work. You're just kind of murking along.
Yeah.
But I did want to say, just on the whole thing of that, I had a little, for me, it was quite a little, I don't know if it's a revelation or if it's to do with the metaphor of the raft. But this thing, you know, when you feel like you're in this thing, and the continually fruiting tree is part of your existence, and even the gem is there, and it's like, oh, and you get this moment, and say you've meditated, there's total calm, you're engaged, there's some higher stuff's open up, and you come out, and then you can just feel like this weird stuff, it starts going wonky, you know, you get this weird doubt or existential weird stuff, the doubt especially. And then I had that the other day, and I found myself scrabbling around in my mind, well, in my mind and my being, scrabbling around to try and find the thread again. And I used to condemn myself for that. I used to think, oh, that's terrible because, you know, there's something wrong with you psychologically, you know, you're just instable. And it's, and you know, and I thought, oh, no, that's not true. I felt like you have those big experiences and they do mess you up. No, they don't mess you up. They kind of open something. And that scrabbling around, okay, to use that metaphor, is the raft. You're desperately trying. You all of a sudden, you've fallen off the boat. And it's actually totally all right to feel like you're scrabbling around for the Dharma again because you're trying to find a life raft. And you'd be an idiot to just be floating around in the stream, being smashed about. I just mean, you know, you can get, do you know what I mean? You can get into a state where you just think, oh God, what am I doing? I need to meditate. I need to, what did the Buddha say? You know, there's this kind of slight panic now and then. Yeah, but I think that's fine.
Because you need to destabilize your ego identity every now and then. And that's an uncomfortable, I guess it's an uncomfortable situation to go through. So you need to kind of...
But I just meant the actual... The actual symbolism of the raft itself, you know, it, because it's not a raft on a raging river. Isn't a cozy experience. You're not there going across with the big thing. Oh, look at the birds. No, and there's nirvana over there. Yeah, I'm coming to nirvana. It's like, you know, and you slipped, you sort of fell off and you're like, oh my shit, where's the raft? So you find yourself paddling furiously. Maybe, you know, and I think, oh, that I used to, all I was saying is I used to really condemn myself for that experience. Like there's something wrong with me. But then I think, no, there's a whole metaphor about this. Rafts aren't cozy places. It's like you're trying to get back on this.
No, it's not raft. A boat.
So that's, I mean, actually, it really connects with the next verse. So I read it because it says, in its protection, as in the protection of a hero, one immediately escapes great dangers, even after committing extremely cruel acts of evil.
Oh, dear.
So why do ignorant beings not seek refuge in it?
I don't know. Why do we not?
So I mean, that really fits with the raft in a way.
Yeah, that was good. Can you read that again?
So in its protection, so we're talking of the awakening mind, the precious jewel. In its protection, as in the protection of a hero, one immediately escapes great dangers, even after committing extremely cruel acts of evil. So why do ignorant beings not seek refuge in it?
Jeez Louise.
I think that's, I mean, it's really interesting. And I mean, I've been pondering about that first verse because of, like, even after committing extremely cruel acts of evil, I mean, having, and so what I thought.
Having experienced the consequences and everything.
So it's interesting. But then I thought, it's the whole area of purification in a sense, like, really, I mean, of course, it's really kind of turning our minds toward the Dharma, toward the skillful, toward the good. And that has a purification, an effect of purifying.
Ah.
I mean, it's really kind of... We turn, the protection is really kind of where we turn our minds towards. And if we, even after having committed something really cruel or unskillful or whatever, turn our minds towards the skillful, that has a positive
That's a good point.
Effect. And there is purification. I mean, I was just remembering the story of one order member who had lived in quite a... what would you say, a criminal life. And then he went, and so what he did was doing the refuge, the going for refuge practice, which is like a prostrating to the three jewels over years and years and years. And at one point he said he suddenly, because he felt like all the guilt and his conscience wasn't clear, but at one point he felt that it was suddenly something lifted and he was kind of purified and freed. So that's something that... I reflected when I thought about that verse.
Yeah, you can see that in I think, a daily experience, even, like, it's a bit of what you were saying, like, you know, even if you have a tough time or you, like, you can't quite see the what you're actually doing and how everything relate, you know, sort of links back to each other, and you're struggling a bit in meditation, or, you know, you don't quite know how to make progress or something, and you just feel like you've reached a dead end or something, then something just, you know, sometimes it just needs, you know, verses from the scripture. I don't know, like, even just listening to a talk and everything kind of falls back into place again, and or even just going on retreat or something, and dedicating yourself anew to your ideals, really. Kind of, well, in my mind, obviously, it can feel quite painful because you have to shift your whole being a bit. But there's definitely that sense of like, relief, and you notice that kind of what you said, purification setting in, of like, just to know what my life is about, and what is good about my knowing the good things in my life and the direction in my life, that is already, well, it's kind of half of, half the bargain. You know, it's like, you've won so much and already has such an effect. It feels like a blessing almost. Yeah. I think that's why it's so important, that kind of...
Well, that language of protection is quite interesting, isn't it? Because you do feel, they say you're protected by your kind of actions, aren't you? You're protected by your skillful, you're protected or not protected by your actions. I think in a way I've had to meet people that I've trusted that have been through that whole process, where you just think, I can purify my consciousness, my life, actually. And you end up, even I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's like you confront your past frankly evil actions, but in the process of confronting it, the fear sort of, either it's there and either it's diminished or it's okay. Like, I definitely had that when there's a retreat, an ordination training retreat called the 10 Pillars, which is basically about the 10 precepts of Buddhism, you know, what you do with your body, your actions of your speech, your actions of your mind. And you really go through the whole thing really thoroughly. So every day it's relentless, you know, it's like a 2-week retreat every day. It's like, right, what have you done with, full speech or cruel speech or what have you done with this? And he's like, oh my God, it's absolutely relentless. But you do feel kind of you feel like it's just the way to go. Mm-hmm. There's no other way around this. You get a sense of yourself, and then it's
confession, isn't it?
Yeah, you confess. And it's funny all that, because I did feel like after doing those retreats, maybe I should do them again, actually. But after doing that particular retreat, I could meditate quite easily, which is interesting. Like all the crap that just gets in my mind, and stupid ideas and endless thinking about, I don't know what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. It does have a strong effect, doesn't it? Confession.
You just let go of stuff. Yeah. You're like, what am I? Oh, yeah, I did that. Okay, I'm really sorry. That was a disgrace. I'm not doing that again.
Yeah.
And then you can meditate. It's like, the threefold path: ethics, meditation, and wisdom. It does actually does actually work. Yeah. There is a point here.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, I guess it's also one of the points, interestingly, in my 9, in the text that I'm currently reflecting on, where it says, like, if you seek samadhi, if you seek absorption and meditation, so the first thing is your ethical practice. Which is quite, I mean, it's obvious in
it's
a way.
So obvious, but so difficult to see.
Difficult. Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, what I'm always so impressed by is kind of because ethics, in a way, is such a weird word, just to kind of see how your behavior, how ethics kind of reaches into all sorts of different aspects of your life and your mind.
Your life.
Yeah, it is your life.
It's literally everything you're ever going to do, think, say. It is you.
Because when I hear ethics, the first idea you have is like, well, what we said before, you're supposed to be generous. Okay, I give a beggar a bit of money. Yeah. And or like, what does Maitreya Vanda always say? It becomes about nuancing consumer choices. Exactly. Whereas ethics is so much more.
It's about you.
Every action of body, speech, and mind.
I mean, on a negative, it's all it's all the things that you don't do. So you're not going to go around murdering people and selling drugs and all this sort of thing, But it's also on the positive. And I just feel like, I thought, oh God, it's just so obvious, isn't it? But I don't care how long you've been practicing. It's really, really difficult to okay, like say ethics, like Maitreya Vanda says, he calls it like behavior. I prefer that. It's just your behavior in every aspect. What are you going to do? How are you going to structure your life in order so you can actually meditate at depth?
Yeah.
What does that look like in your actual life? Because for me, it's been a mystery for a long, long, long time. Not a mystery, but a struggle. I always knew it's possible, but I just thought, well, how am I ever going to get there? But you can, isn't it? And I think that's where the whole thing of renunciation starts to make more sense. It's not a great word, but it's like, either you drop certain things away and they stop messing with your head. Mm. And then when you sit down to meditate, you can meditate at depth. And then it's like the fruit, the tree keeps fruiting. But I think ethics is the wrong word. Mm. It is actually the wrong word, because I think of it as something like there's me here, and then there's this thing I do called ethics.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's me. It's everything I've said and thought and done every moment of the day that's the like expression. The basis. That's the base of the path, isn't it? That's the beginning of the path, which is everything. It's like, okay, the beginning of the path is your whole life.
Yeah.
Everything you're ever going to say, do, or think, just start there. So, oh, great. Mm. That's easy, yeah.
But I guess, like, I'm just thinking again about the image of the hero and the protection. Mm. I guess that's because that's something that really struck me when I read that verse for the first time. And I thought, that's really, if I'm anxious, if I'm afraid or whatever, this is the protection. This is, it really is. I mean, it's probably also trusting that my actions or that positive actions have a positive outcome and that there will be... Mm.
There will be fruit,
A fruit, and that it really makes a difference what I do in this moment. Mm. And so somehow I can seek that protection by actually acting skillfully.
Do you ever have that thing where you it's a bit vague sometimes, isn't it? But where you just... Yeah, it's almost like a, not even an image of yourself, but you just think, I'm gonna be a good person. Like, I want to be, like I say to myself, I want to be a good man. Yeah, I want to, and then everything sorts itself out. The rest of the day's all right. I've lost something. Oh God, I've lost a load of money, or I've done something. It's all kind of not important. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, my plan today is to try and treat people well. Mm-hmm. It's hard, but it's like, if I can do that, then everything, then you're protected. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you've done that, everything's all right. Yeah, you might die, you get some horrible disease, but it's not important. It's not it's not the same thing. It's like, if you've got that thing at the forefront where your goal is to be a decent person, more than decent, hopefully, but like a decent person, you're kind of okay, aren't you? It's like, you get a problem, but it's okay.
Yeah, because I guess you live in line with deeper values somehow that...
They look after you.
Let me just read
of course.
The wrap up. It might fit in here now.
How much longer? What's the time? How long have we been going for?
Not a lot. 10 minutes, maybe.
Oh, okay. We better get into.
Get into the quote. Oh, I haven't quite decided yet which part I'm going to read. Maybe I'm going to read all of it.
Well, where is it from?
I think we have. Well, again, the Dhammapada. So that's my go-to book for quotes. I think I have. I have read the beginning of this chapter already in a previous episode, the one on happiness. I think I did that, right? Happy indeed we live, friendly met the haters. So this is kind of the rest of it. I think I'm just going to read the whole thing.
Yeah, read it.
And then maybe pick out one verse or something. So this is... So this is the rest of it. There's no fire like lust, no blemish like demerit, no suffering like the taking up of the five constituents of conditioned existence, no happiness like peace. Hunger is the worst disease, conditioned existence the worst suffering. Knowing this as it really is, one realizes that nirvana is the highest happiness. Health is the highest gain, contentment the greatest riches. Trustworthy are the best kinsmen. Nirvana is the supreme happiness. Having enjoyed the flavor of solitude and tranquility, free from sorrow and free from sin, one enjoys the rapturous flavor of the truth. Good it is to see the spiritually developed. To actually dwell with them is always happiness. By not seeing the spiritually immature, one indeed will be perpetually happy. By living in company with the spiritually immature, one grieves for a long time. Association with the spiritually immature is always painful, like association with an enemy. Association with the wise is pleasant, like the coming together of relatives. Therefore it is said, follow one who is wise, understanding and learned, who bears the yoke of virtue, is religious and spiritually developed. Follow one of such a nature, as the moon follows the path of the stars.
Hmm. It's nice. It brings back to the beginning of the our conversation with the
teachers,
I thought.
The teachers, yeah. So I think there's, for me, there's mainly two things in here. Well, there's the, you know, the whole thing of friendship, teachers, you know, I think the main verse here really is verse 8, which is, health is the highest gain, contentment the greatest riches, the trustworthy are the best kinsmen, nirvana is the supreme happiness. Because there's everything we've talked about is in there in a way. You know, contentment the greatest riches. I really like that because it's, later on he says that again a bit more clearly, but kind of, you know, ethics, simple life, renunciation. He equates that with the riches, so he equates that with abundance. So being content, being ethically pure, being kind of, you know, actually living a life, like you said, Tarapalata, actually living a life where you can meditate, well, that needs to be a content life. That's the greatest riches, so it's the biggest treasure you can heap up, and then the trustworthy are the best kinsmen. So you, so apparently you do need people, you know, you do need association as well. Well, and then just, you know, nirvana is the supreme happiness. So I think that the second thing here is really the joy, you know. Having enjoyed the flavor of solitude and tranquility, free from sorrow and free from sin. You know, having it as a, so really being absorbed in meditation, in solitude, tranquility, but also being ethically pure, you know, what you say, having confessed. One enjoys the rapturous flavor of the truth. Rapturous flavor of the truth.
Yeah, I think it's great because it really connects with what we've talked about before, because I guess it's really
It worked.
So I guess because we, I guess it's all the conditions that you need to set up, purify your mind, go for refuge, be content, be ethical, to actually allow the nirvana or like the awakening mind, the bodhicitta to kind of shine through somehow, to kind of come through and create that deeper sense of happiness and fulfillment in a way. But you need to kind of create those conditions and calm the mind in order to have that gem shine.
It shows that, sorry, it shows that, you know, when we talk about renunciation and meditation, it shows that those are just preliminary practices. They're just preparations. You know, they're not an end in itself. They are so that, you know, you can actually enjoy the rapturous flavor of the truth, that you can actually grasp the the awakening
mind.
It
really does speak to the whole kind of riddle of life in a way, though. It sounds a bit pretentious saying that, but it's true. It speaks to the whole, it is a riddle, you know, the whole contentment being the greatest riches. Normally, I don't know about anyone else, but I've approached my life from the completely other end of the lens. You know, it's like when I get all the riches, I'll be content because I have everything, I can chill. And then you keep doing that for longer and longer, and you think you get more and more discontented. And so it's kind of, it's interesting, is it positing a complete reversal of how you actually, how you're going to get contented, but then how getting contented, that's a huge, that's everything,
that's
isn't
a huge,
it? You've changed, you've got to reverse your entire way of looking at the world, really.
But it also shows, you know, like when we talk about renunciation, I mean, obviously that kind of, I mean, it sounds a bit, I mean, who wants renunciation? But
not me.
But I want the rapturous flavor of the truth. Yeah, that's what I want. Okay, what do I need to do in order to get the rapturous flavor of truth?
Some renunciation.
But then I'm willing to do it.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, I'm willing to put that in.
Yeah, but then you've got to look at what renunciation is then. Exactly. It's not just like hair, shirts and whipping yourself, is it?
No.
Although people like to do that in Berlin, I'm told. But, you know, it's just like it's actually something
not
else.
Right now, but
not right now.
Before Corona.
In that other club you were talking about. But anyway, we won't go there. That's a different place. But yeah, no, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think renunciation is such a massive part of Buddhism, huge. And like the way whenever we talk about it, there's a kind of weird atmosphere in the room, like, you know, but actually, if you take it in the right spirit, then you get, I think that's, it's the, again, it's the, oh, look how good we are. It's the continually fruiting tree, isn't it? You get a taste of that and you're like, mmm, yum, yum, like fruiting tree. And then it's like, oh, just watch those on Netflix. Oh, I've lost the fruiting tree.
Don't do that.
Oh, I've got into this terrible state of prepantra and like evil, weird thinking, and I've lost the tree again. Oh, back to the tree. Mm, nice. So it's like, you just don't want to do it because it's crap.
I guess because it's really attractive. Like the renunciation can become attractive if you see
just
it more.
It's a bad word.
Yeah, it's a bad word because it's liberating. It's just you can leave things behind that are probably.
Why do we call you? What's the actual word? Dhammasara.
Of renunciation. Oh,
you forgotten that last. I've got you. You don't know.
It doesn't come to mind at the moment.
Maybe we should have another episode on renunciation and contentment.
Oh, that's going to be really popular. Renunciation.
Look, I actually can't think of it at all.
What is it?
I don't even know what going forth is at the moment in Pali. I will look it up.
It's a huge area.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Stillness. I mean, I like stillness somehow. Yeah. Contentment and stillness.
It's to do with the tree, though. It's to do with the fruits. You know, and once you get a taste of the fruits, it stops becoming renunciation. You know, it just becomes a pain. It's just like, why am I doing this to myself? I told you, I've got a little, you know, on iPhones, you can create little squares where you have multiple apps in the same square. Yeah. I've got Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. I don't never look at Instagram anyway. I've got them all in this little square, and it's called prison, poison, pressure, pain. So it's just like, and it just reminds me every time I'm about to click on it, I'm like, read it, prison. Okay, so I still click on it, but at least I know that it's putting in the little reminders. Yeah, it's taking me away from the tree.
Yeah,
Taking me away from that kind of sweet spot, the good things in life.
Yeah.
Anyway.
By living in company with the spiritually immature, one grieves for a long time.
God, tell me about it.
Association with the spiritually immature is always painful, like association with an enemy.
Oof.
Association with the wise is pleasant, like the coming together of relatives.
Yeah.
That's very interesting, this whole relative, you know, this whole family. Mm. I mean, the Buddha talks in terms of, you know, you are offspring of my mouth. You know, you're sons and daughters
children
of the Shakyans.
Of the Buddha.
So there's this whole family aspect, but when you come together with people, with especially the wise, I do get that feeling a lot of like, you can just kind of relax and you know, whenever you
interesting conversation,
be yourself,
natural,
they're just interested in you, and you know, they give you a bit of perspective, and
you don't have to grind out conversations.
Well, sometimes you do,
but
and there is this inspiration as well, I guess, that which is also something that can come up of conversation with the wise somehow. You really get this kind of positive inspiration gets fired.
It's the kind of best in you, isn't it? The actual energy, the light, even the life force, the thing that's
the
actually
wish to practice.
Yeah, the most interesting thing. You're not just sitting around kind of like, oh, desperately trying to find a conversation to put together and you know, drag a bit from here, and it's like it's such a relaxing kind of uplifting sense, isn't it, where you can actually just talk about what's most important to you.
I think that's something that's really lost, or at least wasn't so present in my upbringing, this whole teacher-student kind of relationship of having someone to go to just ask kind of life questions, but with whom you can also just be a friend and kind of who just takes you as a person and not just helps you in a particular subject at school or something, but just where you can just kind of, well, bring everything you have and then... it's just being looked at with wisdom and love and compassion. Anyway, I'll just end with the last verse and then therefore it is said, follow one who is wise, understanding and learned, who bears the yoke of virtue, is religious and spiritually developed. Follow one of such a nature as the moon follows the path of the stars.
Why don't we just leave it there?
Yeah.
Thank you. It was a great conversation.
Good. Yeah. Thank you very much.
I
enjoyed that.
Bye bye.
Ciao.
See you soon.
See you next time.